Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Today's program is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
This is Sherry Bayer from All in the Industry. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
I'm Carmen DeVito.
And I'm Alice Marcus Krieg.
And we are collectively Groundworks, Inc. We design and build gardens in New York City and the surrounding area, and our show aims to bring some culture to horticulture.
Yes.
So I'm sounding a little far away today because I am out in the field, and Alice is in the studio, but we have a live guest in the studio we're super excited about.
Sure.
So tomorrow's election day, and we thought that it would be fitting to do a short series on politics and place. That sounds like somebody's bad dissertation topic, I know. but we're going to start with today's show, which is, I think, a very interesting place to start the conversation, because it's about that which nourishes us and gives us pleasure, food. And what's more political than what goes in your mouth? Right? It doesn't get more political than that at every level.
I could make so many jokes. Right,
I know,
now.
I know. And it's going to get dirtier before the day's up. So on this series, over the course of the next few weeks, Alice and I are going to cover community garden movements and urban park movements. And we're going to talk to the influencers, the people that make change happen in our communities. Long after the election is over, we the people will need to continue to work and build our nation and strengthen our democracy, regardless of who sits in the Oval Office.
Luck be a lady.
Oh. Right. No, of course. Heritage Radio programs are no stranger to political discourse. Indeed, many shows have covered the intersection of food and culture from a lot of different angles, because our food is and always has been intertwined with our identity as a nation and as citizens, starting with the Boston Tea Party. Right?
I do remember that, yes.
Yeah, tea, there was food involved. So as I imagine it was during those early years of our history, it's been a rough year. I think everybody can agree on that. So much divisiveness and ugly rhetoric that has come out from both sides that our nation feels very divided. And it seems we can't agree on much. But I think we can agree on one thing. Ours is a nation made by immigrants. You can call them pilgrims, indentured servants, even refugees, but they all came from somewhere else to build something new here. And the politics of where they came from often propel them here.
Mm-hmm.
Just exactly. And just as the changing political climate of the U.S. shaped their ability to come here at all, as well as shaped their experience here. And finally, as our guest Sarah Lohman will discuss on today's show, ultimately, change reshaped the nation, including what we eat and what we consider American food. So what do Japanese picture brides, an orphan abandoned during the French Revolution, a young Japanese chemist, a sailor with the British East India Company, and a 19th century German immigrant have in common? Today's guest, our good friend and culinary historian Sarah Lohman, answers this question brilliantly in her new book, Eight Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Alice, will you tell our guests a little bit about Sarah?
Yes. So Sarah is no stranger to us. We've done a few other shows with her. We were just talking. We did a tomato show, a pear show, and I think a pumpkin show, too.
Or at least if we haven't, we should.
We That's should. What we said, yeah. Exactly. So Sarah's a good friend of ours. Sarah and I met at a bread and beer event mm-hmm. at the Old Stone House. And, of course, I was immediately taken with her. She's originally from Hinckley, Ohio, where I'm from Ohio, too. So we have that what's high in the middle and round on the ends.
Ohio. O-H-I-O.
Yeah. where she began working in a museum at the age of 16. She was cooking historic food over a wood-burning stove. She graduated with a BFA from the Cleveland Institute of Art in 2005, and for her undergraduate thesis, she opened a temporary restaurant installation that reinterpreted food of the colonial era for a modern audience. She moved to New York in 2006 and worked as a video producer for New York Magazine's food blog, Grub Street. She left the position in 2009 to launch her own business. Dubbed a historical gastronomist, she recreates historic recipes as a way to make a personal connection with the past. She chronicles her explorations in culinary history on her blog, 4 Pounds Flour, and her work has been featured in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and on NPR. She works with museums and galleries around the country to create public programs focused on food, including institutions such as the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, the American Museum of Natural History, the Institute for Culinary Education, and the Museum of Science in Boston. She's appeared on New York City TV's miniseries Appetite City, cooking culinary treats from New York's past, and is featured on the Cooking Channel's Food. Fact or Fiction, 8 Flavors is her first book, and that's what we're going to talk about today.
Yay.
So thanks for joining us
I'm
again.
I'm so happy to be here.
The book is an amazing read.
Thank you.
It's coming out on December 6th,
December 6th, correct, but it is available for pre-sale right now, so you can go on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, your bookseller of choice, and pick yourself up a copy.
Right. What we liked about your book is that it's chronological. I always love chronological. You know,
I'm the simple thing.
Simpleton, yeah. Right. So let's talk about the order of flavor and when and how it was introduced into cuisine. The first chapter is black pepper, pepper nigrum, which is a very vigorous growing vine native to South Asia. Tell us about the Crowninshield family.
The Crowninshield family of Salem, Massachusetts.
Yeah.
So, the book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine, I looked into recipes and actually used Google Ngram Viewer, too. If you don't know what that is, look it up, to sort of plot when flavors were coming into our diets over time. And I looked particular at ones that are not only very popular, but have never ebbed in their popularity. That they've been pretty consistently and growing in popularity. And the first one I thought that was relevant as an American flavor was black pepper. Up until the Revolutionary War, most of our commodities were sold through England. They had a monopoly on trade, which that's one of the reasons we threw tea into the harbor, because we were upset of we were getting
the short end of the
stick.
Yeah,
we were getting really, really high for this commodity. So, but then the problem was after the Revolutionary War, we didn't know where a lot of these commodities came from, including black pepper. And this was part of England's plan, Britain's plan. They wanted to keep these trade routes secret. Mm-hmm. So we couldn't just get on a ship and go buy it from wherever it came from, and England had a monopoly in the pepper trades. What were we going to do? Apparently, someone was in Sumatra trading for a variety of things, and they got a hot tip that that black pepper was grown on like the northwest coast of Sumatra. So then a bunch of merchants in Salem, very powerful and soon to be very wealthy men, a lot of them hadn't made money as privateers in the Revolutionary War, organized a trip out there to see if it was true. And this first vessel, the Raja, came back with a couple 100,000 pounds of pepper, which sold at about a 75% profit.
So this was an American ship.
This is an American ship, the Raja, that left from Salem, Massachusetts.
Raja.
The Raja. That was the very first one.
Uh-huh.
And then it was the Crowninshield family that they... The people in the Raja tried to keep it secret, but the Crown and Shields found out somehow. And so then between about 1801 and 1806, they launched 3 more voyages, and they brought back about 1 million pounds of pepper and sold it for pretty much the same amount of profit in the money of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So black pepper created the first millionaires in this country. But to me, the part of the story that really fascinated me was, when they showed up in in Sumatra, these plantations had been selling to the English. And the way that the Americans merchants got the trade away from the British is that they were nice to the people in Sumatra. Imagine that. It's in a way, it's almost an anti-colonialization story, because the Brits were there, they were living there, they were bribing powerful people and essentially forcibly making natives grow plantations, and also keeping the price really low because of monopoly. So we showed up and we offered a fair price, and we were really nice, and we didn't attack anyone, and we were nice to the women too, which is always great, right? Mm-hmm. And within about 40 years, we had completely stolen the trade away from the British, because the peoples who lived there had no interest in trading with people who tried to subjugate them, mm-hmm. when they had a more profitable and more healthy relationship with the American merchants. Mm-hmm. And I learned this from journals of the time. Mm-hmm. And the paraphrase, the journals, it's like the John Crowninshield, who made one of the first voyages, was like, hey, you know, I heard you guys were like really mean, but you're not really mean at all. And the people who were there, the Akinese, were like, really? You were mean? He's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I think it was just the British being like, no, don't trade with them. They'll chop off your head. And the Akinese were like, well, I hope you like us now. And he's like, yeah, you guys are great. And then I imagine they high-fived and like got on a boat. And that was the end of that. So yeah. It ended up, that was a very, very interesting thing to stumble upon, to discover this really amicable trade between Sumatra and America.
And the British must, like, their heads must have been exploding.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, they're pretty state, like, their mode of operation in the 19th century was to subjugate and colonize, mm-hmm. and brutalize, mm-hmm. And make other people's lives pretty miserable in these, mm-hmm. nations. And that, at least for these merchants in Salem, we realized that that wasn't good business, mm-hmm. that we would be doing a lot better business by being really nice. Mm-hmm. And it didn't work all the time, and some fighting did break out sometime, but overall, it was the whole basis for this trade. Be nice.
Yeah.
Be nice. Wow.
Yeah.
That's like all you got to do.
It's a fundamental, yeah. You know, let's see if, well, anyway, I'm going to reserve some comment.
Yeah. Be nice, yeah. This election. Be nice.
Be nice. So vanilla. Let's talk about vanilla.
Yeah.
It is, you cannot have a baked good without vanilla. It's actually my favorite flavor.
Yes, yes.
So tell us the story of vanilla, and you went to a plantation.
Yeah.
Tell us about how it's harvested. It's such a fascinating story.
Yeah. So vanilla is actually the idea that really sort of sparked this book, because I used to work with early 19th, 18th century recipes, and I just noticed that there wasn't any vanilla included in these recipes. But then by the end of the 19th century, it was used just as often as we use it today.
Okay.
So I was like, okay, there's got to be this turning point. And it actually has a lot to do with the agriculture of vanilla. It's native to Mexico, mm-hmm. And I feel like we're often very removed from what vanilla actually is. You know, we get it as a liquid in a bottle, but don't think about where it comes from.
Right.
It is the fruit of an orchid, mm-hmm. That it's native to central Mexico. That's where all the edible species of this orchid live, with the vanilla orchid. And to a certain extent, it's still produced there too. So I went to the Gaia Plantation, which is in Veracruz, which is along the Gulf Coast, the east coast of Mexico, and is the traditional vanilla growing region. It's the biggest plantation in this region. So vanilla is grown in this plantation in greenhouses, but in nearby farms, it trained up orange trees or cacao trees, mm-hmm. to make this sort of double profitability for the local farmers too. It blossoms in early spring, and the blossoms they shrivel and die before noon. So in that time, as these plants are blooming for about a week, an army of seasonal workers goes in and hand pollinates these orchids. And that's actually was the tipping point. We had been interested in vanilla since the 18th century and had been starting to export it, but when the plants were taken somewhere else, they would bloom but not fruit. Mm-hmm. And they were taken away from native pollinators, mm-hmm. and actually we're not sure exactly what native pollinators to this day, but they weren't producing in other nations. Until in 1841, a 12-year-old slave named Edmund Albius, who lived in Madagascar, figured it out. He worked for a master that had educated him and encouraged his interest in botany, and then he figured out how to hand pollinate vanilla and change the world, in terms of what we eat, what we bake, the flavors that we cook with, and particularly Americans. So I didn't get to see them hand pollinated, but I saw the beans ripening on the vines are these long green beans. They go into a curing house where they're steamed and then dried and cured in the sun for several months. Mm-hmm. And that's actually what matures the flavor of vanilla. Fresh vanilla beans don't smell like vanilla. You have to bring a couple different chemicals together from different parts of the vanilla bean, and you do that by breaking down the cell walls through the steaming and curing process. Those chemicals come together and create vanillin, which accounts for about a third of our sensory experience of taste and smell when we're consuming vanilla bean.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And it's new to the West, but isn't it true that the Aztecs or the Maya did use vanilla?
Yeah, yes, both actually. The Maya were the first to cultivate it.
Okay.
They would bring it from parts of their empire that were tropical and bring it to the Yucatan, which is much more arid. But in the Yucatan, there are these things called cenotes, which if any listeners ever visited, it's like fashionable to go swimming in a cenote. They're these sunken limestone caverns that have created these tropical microclimates. And the Maya, we're talking about 2,000 years ago, were using these microclimates to grow luxury gardens. So they imported cacao trees and grew them, and they imported vanilla vines because they liked to drink chocolate, and vanilla was one of the most common flavors used with chocolate.
Mm-hmm.
The
That's
Aztecs
amazing.
Also
vanilla
like chocolate.
Together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We think of them as opposites, vanilla or chocolate, but even when they were then transported to Europe after colonization from Spain, the reason vanilla ends up in Europe is because it's brought in as a chocolate ingredient. So it's not really until, well, it's hard to say when vanilla was used by itself. It was probably in a custard, probably in the 18th century and probably in France, but it would have taken a little bit of inspiration to use that ingredient on its own because that's not how we'd been using it before.
So fascinating.
That's interesting. Wow.
Well, Sarah brought in some treats.
She did.
And we just talked about
black pepper.
We just talked about black pepper. So she brought in some black pepper cookies.
Yeah, this is actually, so the book also has recipes in it too.
Uh-huh.
So not only is it sort of a personal account of my travels and my studies and also an account of people of the time, but in every chapter I include three recipes. Some of them are sort of modern interpretations, but most of them are historic recipes that I thought were accessible and interesting and maybe easy enough to try.
Mm-hmm.
So these are black pepper brown sugar cookies. They're inspired by a recipe in Martha Washington's manuscript. She has a manuscript called The Book of Cookery, full of recipes.
And I have to say, this is a beautiful maple leaf
I know,
black pepper
fall
cookie.
Fall leaves, because it's November. I thought it went good with the color.
Mm.
So it's fresh cracked black pepper, coriander, other spices, brown sugar. And then when you roll the cookies out, you put a little bit more fresh black pepper on top.
Mm.
Historically, black pepper was used as not just as a savory spice like we use it today, but you'd use it in spice cookies just like this. And gingerbread always had black pepper in it, which is not really so common anymore.
Everyone's so excited about salt and chocolate, you know? And that's what's so nice about this.
Yeah.
It's just a little different.
Yeah.
It's really...
I think it's coming around now, too, Sarah, right? We're bringing the savory back into the sweet. We're adding... I feel like it's coming back around as it was, you know, just rediscovering different combinations.
Yeah, and I think that in the 21st century, we just have a very open mind as to what flavors can go where. But one of the reasons I've always been drawn to historic food is because something like putting black pepper in a cookie feels very modern and feels very 21st century. But this recipe, well, no one knows exactly where it's from, but it's from the 18th century at the latest. So that is what I really like about the work that I do, finding these inspiring recipes that seem super modern but are actually really quite old.
I always think of pepper as a meat preservative.
Yes, definitely. So one of the aspects of pepper that might account for the reason why we like it so much and consume so much of it is that it does have antimicrobial properties.
Mm-hmm.
There's a very interesting study done by Cornell where they basically made a bunch of pot roasts with different spices, put them on a shelf, and saw which one lasted the longest. And they discovered that spices also kill bacteria, kill other microbes, and help preserve food longer.
Mm-hmm.
Not just black pepper, but garlic and chili powder, two other flavors I explore, they kill about 100% of microbes they come in contact with. So there's a correlation between spicy food and hot climates, because the highly spiced food would have preserved food better in hot climates.
I wondered about why that was the case, because it seemed almost counterintuitive, Sarah, to eat spicy things. I heard it was because it allows you to sweat more, right?
Yeah, that is the popular myth, and that is basically not true. Eating hot food doesn't cool you down, but it seems that eating hot food helps you to stop get food poisoning. And there's another level to that, too. You probably remember I learned in grade school that people used a lot of spices in medieval cooking because it was to hide the taste of bad meat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right.
But that doesn't make sense because in medieval times, spice was really, really, really expensive. So if you could afford cinnamon, that meant you could afford good meat. Mm-hmm. So it actually seems to be misinterpreted. If I am crusting my steak with a heavy coat of black pepper, what I'm doing is I'm adding something that's antimicrobial to it. So as opposed to hiding the taste of bad meat, the pepper, the spices are probably preserving meat so it doesn't go bad.
So this was a fun part for me in your book. You talk early on in your book about these antimicrobial characters. And then you talk about natural selection. And I think this is the best, like, Darwinian, amazing. I'm going to read a little bit. So, foods cooked with these spices were better preserved, and in a time before refrigeration, the people who ate them were at a lower risk of foodborne illness. They were healthier and they lived longer than people who did not consume spicy food. So they had more children. Natural selection favored those who ate spicy food because they survived, and the preference for spicy food became a dominant trait in humanity.
Yep.
It's just brilliant.
And there's other stuff, too, that I was really surprised. A lot of very strongly flavored foods we eat show up in amniotic fluid and in breast milk. Mm-hmm. So scientists believe that these advanced flavor preferences before you're even born is helping to teach your children what is not poisonous, what is good for you and what is bad for you before they even leave your body, which kind of blows my mind.
Mm-hmm. That is amazing.
And Carmen, I thought of you too, because when I was researching the garlic chapter, garlic is one of the flavors that is very prominent in this way. It shows up in amniotic fluid and in breast milk. And so, in a way...
Oh, yeah. Sarah, I ate a slice of pizza with garlic powder every single day from, like, the third month on to like a birth. I pretty much ate.
So you're creating the next generation of garlic lovers. We went from a culture in America that hated garlic to loving it in about 70 years. And that's a lot of the reason, or that's one of the theories that I put out there, that it's not just that culture was changing, is that the biological makeup of Americans were changing because we became a generation of children and then another generation of children born to a lot of us Italian immigrant parents or our grandparents. And garlic became a part of who we were.
And it was inexpensive, garlic, compared to some of the other spices.
Yes, absolutely. In fact, garlic in the 19th and 18th century was considered poverty food. Uh-huh. If you had money, you imported spices. If you didn't, you used herbs. That was essentially like the rule of thumb, the stereotypes, let's say. But yeah, a little bit of garlic goes a long way to make bad food taste really, really good.
And Carmen, you had a funny, we were kind of talking about this before the show, you had a funny statement where you said, in fact, you hint in the book that the smell of garlic was considered almost un-American. If you smell like it, you're not assimilating.
Definitely.
So tell us, Sarah, how did garlic go mainstream? Because it was kind of like there were two paths that allowed it to come into our cuisine. And I don't think people know that story. I mean, they assume the Italian part, but there's another part.
Right. And I was really surprised by this kind of twist, too. So sure, around the turn of the century, millions of Italian immigrants came to this country, and one of the signatures of their cuisine was garlic. But the idea was, if you come to this country, you got to speak English, dress American, and you should be eating American food. But the Italians, there was actually a 40% repatriation rate amongst Italians. I mean, almost half of all Italian immigrants ended up going home. Either because they didn't like it, or a lot of them came as seasonal workers. If this sounds familiar, it should be sounding familiar already. Yeah. So if you're only here and you're not planning on staying, you're really resistant to assimilation, I think with good reason. Yeah. So in one way, there were Italians, they were cooking with garlic, and the general American population said garlic is disgusting, we hate the way it tastes. It became really represented of this other culture that was living in America and not behaving like an American. So how did we go from that to now Americans consume more garlic than any other flavor I mentioned in the book? It's by far the most popular. And oddly, it actually comes through French cuisine. World War II happens. A lot of men are stationed in both Italy, but in southern France. James Beard is actually stationed in Provence during World War II. And immediately, in between the two world wars, a lot of artists, writers, musicians from America were also living in France, too, and also living in Provence. Provence Provençal cuisine, because its proximity to Italy and its Mediterranean climate, is very garlic heavy. So shortly after World War II, it became very fashionable to mimic the French, and Provençal cuisine specifically was fashionable. MFK Fisher writes about it, Julia Child wrote about it, and James Beard really introduced it to this country with his recipe for chicken with 40 cloves of garlic. So it was seen as typical of Provençal cuisine, and we've always wanted to mimic the French. Like, that's something that's happened for a long time in this country in terms of cuisine. And so it was then through Provençal cuisine in America, but then by the time this was happening in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, Italian Americans were one and two generations American. It was now their parents or grandparents who had immigrated. So then at the same time, a lot of Italians started coming out of the closet about their love of garlic.
De rigueur.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So by the 70s, it's this combination of Provençal cuisine and which is getting a lot of, what's the word I want? It's happening in California in a big way too, the sort of farm to table movement. Plus, Italians are now Americans, and so they are bringing it into American cuisine.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's weird. You think of pizza, right? Yeah. I'm an immigrant.
Yeah.
And I think of pizza as an American food.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, even though, of course, they have it in Italy, and I eat it in Italy, and it's wonderful, but I completely think of it as an American food.
To me, that's some of the beauty of American cuisine. I feel like we talk as though we don't have a national cuisine, or that somehow it's inauthentic. Like, for every person that says, I love pizza, there's someone else going, oh, well, pizza in Italy is totally different. And you're like, shut up.
That's just snotty.
It is snotty. We're not in Italy, but people see that as a fault of American food, and I see it as something awesome. People come here, the food evolves. They're looking at what the people living next to them are doing, who are coming from a totally different part of Italy or a totally different country, and they're creating something new that could not be created anywhere else. I think it's awesome.
But wasn't pizza one of the, like, introductory products from the World's Fair?
Oh, I actually don't know about pizza, but I'm obsessed with the World's Fair in terms of
food. I thought it was a World's Fair introduction.
Food. I mean, you'll be amazed at what foods were introduced at the World's Fair. For example, the first tandoori oven was at the 1964 World's Fair, and that's where naan and tandoori chicken was served for the first time known in America.
Right.
But in terms of pizza, I will tell you this. This happened both with Italian food and Chinese American food. These two movements were typified in its early years by men. Men are coming here, men are working, and they're coming from cultures where women traditionally did the cooking. So these men are coming here, and they want the food they had back home, whether that's pizza or stir fry, whatever it is, but they never cooked it. So men are trying to recreate from memory these foods that they want to have again, don't necessarily have the access to all the necessary ingredients to. And so that is another very uniquely American way that food evolved here. Mm-hmm. You've got these men who know nothing, trying to create this new food. And that's how we end up with things like American pizza and chop suey.
Right.
It's also a break from tradition, too. Americans aren't tied by tradition. In other countries, food is made the same way for hundreds, if not thousands of years because of tradition.
Right.
Our food evolves very, very quickly because we don't have those same
necessity.
Ties.
Yeah. Right.
That was one of the frustrations I had. I go to Italy relatively often, and I find that there's such a... there's almost like a provincial attitude, Sarah, in places. They won't, you know, and I respect that. Certain shapes of pasta go with certain kinds of sauce,
right,
et cetera. They won't, they're shocked by blending, you know, when I describe, like, blending certain flavors together, they're just, like, appalled by it. There isn't a kind, and maybe it will change as Europe becomes a little more diversified, let's say. There's a certain, like, narrow-mindedness based out of tradition and a long, wonderful, tasty tradition. It is. I totally get that, you know?
Yeah.
What's great about America is that
we're open.
I can come here.
We experiment.
I can try. I can see 100 different cuisines on the shelf, different ingredients, try it and mix it and blend it with what I know of my own tradition and make something completely unique.
Right.
I talked to Mario Carbone about this. He's the chef that's Carbone's Men's Restaurants, Parm, former Trucci Family Specialties. He kind of said the same thing, but then he said his view is Italian-American food, it evolved here just like it's another province of Italy. So you can't compare it back to food back in Italy because it is so Provenzo. You wouldn't take a dish or an ingredient from one province and make it in another. So, okay, here we are in like New York and New Jersey, and like this is just another province of Italy. Mm-hmm. People came here from all over Italy. They started forming a new culture and formed a new cuisine because of it. So that doesn't mean that Italian-American food is any less worthy or less authentic. It evolved in a different direction because it had to, because it was natural for it to, because this isn't Italy. It was a nation full of Italians that kept cooking food.
Mm-hmm. We have to take a break. Hang on to the line. We are here with Sarah Lohman talking about food and how it or tastes and how they have traversed the world. You're listening to We Dig Plants on Heritage Radio Network.
And this one is called Mad as Dogs by the Hollows. We'll be right back.
The following program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential small hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 40 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail and listen to live jazz in one of their cozy Victorian seating areas. Mingle with travelers from around the world who find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Hi, welcome back. We're talking with Sarah Lohman and her new book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine. Before the break, we were talking about garlic and Italy and pizza. So, Carmen, I want you to talk about the first time you had chili.
Yes. So I married somebody from Kansas. I'm a first generation. I don't even know what generation I am. I was born in Italy and I came here as a child. So I don't know. What does that make me, Sarah?
Generation 1.5 is the actual term for it. How old
I'm
were you when you came?
1.5?
Mm-hmm. How old?
Okay. So I'm a 1.5-er.
Yeah.
So we ate very, very traditional Italian cuisine. My parents mm-hmm. didn't really deviate from anything that wasn't like on their plate.
Wait, Carmen, you told me about mozzarella on white bread.
Mm.
Oh God. That was a hybrid that didn't work out. They did deviate sometimes, but my mother would put the American mozzarella, you know, the polio,
yeah,
that's like rubbery.
Yeah.
And then she would put it on white bread thinking that she would, like, you know, let's have her taste some, like, you
American
know, let's
cuisine.
Compromise. Let's have a little, it was
yeah.
like the most awful combination.
Oh
like, it's like a dog eating peanut butter. Like,
oh, that was like, death. Nobody was trading me for that ever at lunch. But anyway, so we always ate very traditional things. My dad was like a food Nazi, you know, and mm-hmm. he still is. But when I got married, I married somebody from Kansas. And one of the gifts from my mother-in-law, I saw that she had, we didn't have cookbooks in our house too, Sarah, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
No cookbooks. Everything was like off the top of my mother's head. I saw that my mother-in-law, Gail, had the joy of cooking one day when I was visiting her, and I like was perusing through it, and I was like, wow, a book that has raccoon recipes? You gotta love it, you know?
Yeah.
How to skin a squirrel.
So, you know, I said I was really admiring it, and she gave it to me as one of our wedding gifts. So I was going through it, and I was like, Rob's like, oh, can you make chili? And I said, well, what's chili? And he said, it's my mom makes the recipe out of that, used to make it all the time out of that book. So I made chili, and Sarah, I was like blown away. I mean, how could you not love a thing that has like meat
yeah.
and bacon fat
yeah.
and lard and tomatoes and,
yeah.
and so
and chilies
and
yeah.
chilies. So I made that and I fell in love with it and I make it all the time. And when I was reading the chapter about the chili queens and how chili, like kind of like the recipe came before the ingredient. I thought that was really interesting, and I'd love for you to share that story with the listeners.
Yeah, we've got some early documentation of chili being described when, here's a great story. So Texas is part of Mexico, but the Mexican government couldn't get people to settle Texas. It was just too far flung. The soil wasn't good. So they opened up the land to Americans and started selling it about half the cost of the acreage is being sold in America. So there was this wave of immigration from America to Mexico, so much so that at a certain point, the Mexican government tried to ban immigrants from America to Mexico.
Okay, they built a wall.
You need to repeat that.
So
I'd have seriously, repeat that.
I'd have to look up the exact year. It was in the 1830s. There was a law the Mexican government passed to try to ban immigration from America to Mexico because too many Americans were trying to get in to Mexico.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Hear that, Trump?
The Law of April 6th is what it was called. And it was actually kind of the start of Texas independence. The Texians is what the Americans living in Texas were called. So in those early journals, like 1820s, 1830s, we see chili described. It's named in a book by a medical officer who fought in the Mexican-American War. He calls it chili con carne. It's the first time we have it in name. And that war has a lot to do with it. War does a lot to propagate new flavor trends, new food trends. Because not only are we going to a new country, but oftentimes there's a lot of immigration that follows up a war. Mm-hmm. Mexican-American War, World War II, and now because we've been in the Middle East for about 20 years, we're seeing the same thing, that our food is becoming a lot more Middle Eastern because of our ongoing relationship with the Middle East. So chili becomes like the thing to do when you visit San Antonio after the Mexican-American War is over and Texas becomes a state. And there are these group of entrepreneurial Mexican women living now in Texas/America who would be on the plaza in front of the Alamo selling chili to you. And it was for the locals, but it was totally like the tourist thing that
the
you did too.
The first food truck.
Yeah, really, people are kind of recognized. I mean, there were mobile food vendors all over the place, but in a way, they're sort of idolized as one of the first groups of women who are out on the streets. And because they were like so famous, because it was fun. You went and sat at these big long tables, and there was just like every type of person there. And it was run by a Mexican family, but they'd put their like prettiest unmarried daughter out front. And for her, this was a chance for freedom. And what was a very conservative religious society too. She now has this opportunity to be the center of attention mm-hmm. and flirt and be, you know, part of this business that's supporting her family. Mm-hmm. So it was very, very freeing for these women too. Texas, though, has a lot of German immigrants in the middle of the 19th century, something else we don't consider. But chicken fried steak, that's just Wiener Schnitzel. Like, mm-hmm. There's a heavy German influence in the foods. And it was a German, a guy who worked in a German beer hall named William Gebhardt. He would make chili for the people who ate at his beer hall. And one day he was processing batches of chili peppers. And he was just like, oh, this is terrible work. And it stings and it's awful. There's got to be a shorter way to do this. And so he took this idea of chili that the chili queens popularized, and he created chili powder, this German immigrant to Texas. And then now that you could sort of just buy this pre-made seasoning, mm-hmm. chili spreads all across the country and becomes this really American dish with a lot of different variations.
I love that. I love that everybody's hand is in it.
Yeah.
You know? It's like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And it's a lot of people, it's another interesting dish too that Mexico will now say is American in some ways, very condescendingly, like, oh, this American food. Mm-hmm. But it's, and Americans will say it the other way. They're like, yes, this is American food. We're proud of it. But it's both or neither. Like mm-hmm. it was definitely being first prepared by Mexican families in Mexico, even though there's no modern, there kind of are some modern descendants of Mexican cuisine today, it just evolved in a different direction. So it wouldn't be here without Mexico, and it wouldn't be what it is without Americans either.
Mm-hmm. And there's chili queens now, Sarah, right? There's some kind of nouveau chili queens in San Antonio.
Yeah, with the food truck movement and that being opened back up again, there are people who are sort of paying homage to the chili queens too. There's the Institute of Chili, who does not only chili, but also these kind of amazing Southwest flavored shaved ice concoctions that will have like pickles and chili powder. And it's like pretty incredible. And then a good friend of mine at Hamilton, he has a truck called the Texas Chili Queens, and they are drag queens at that chili train truck. So it's definitely a new modern spin. But their kind of take on it is, you know, we're not calling ourselves the chili queen. A chili queen is any woman who's making her living by selling food. And it's to try to give a nod to that tradition.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Alice won,
won
People's Choice.
At the Chili Festival.
Yeah.
Chili Smackdown.
I'm really fascinated by chili competitions, too, because they're often so masculine. So good on you, Alice.
Well, it was amazing. And it was Matt Timms, who used to have a show here.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And I just enter. I love making chili, and my husband and I spend a lot of weekends mm-hmm. making it. And, you know, we would have friends over, and people would say, like, that you have really good chili. And I was like, you know what?
Yeah.
Let me just enter this.
Yeah.
And then I won the People's Choice.
Yay.
And there were so many fancy people next to us making just ridiculous things in the chili.
Mm-hmm.
And then my good old, like...
chili.
Just, you know, and that was the best thing is that the judges said, this is the chili I would want to eat every day.
Oh,
and for
nice.
Me, that was all I wanted was just like, this is the chili that you want to eat every day.
There's
you know?
A section in the book too, about the first big chili cook-off in Terlingua, Texas, which was between two men and it was between a Texan and a New Yorker. And that's how the whole kind of rivalry started because this New Yorker was making chili that had red bell peppers and beans and a dash of MSG
right.
and said, this is the best chili ever. And Texas just went, what? No. Oh, there's only one way to make chili.
Yeah.
But there's not anymore. You can travel the country and there's a lot. I mean, we're from Ohio. Cincinnati
right.
style chili.
Right, right.
Weirdest chili ever.
Right.
Has like cinnamon in it. It's
yeah.
so strange tasting.
Well, the cinnamon chocolate
yeah.
thing is like the mole, you know,
yeah.
that's where it comes from. But it's a fascinating dish because everybody can incorporate something from their past in it.
Yeah.
So it's really evolved.
Or just make it the way you want. Like, that's my whole
yeah.
attitude on American food.
Yeah.
Like, just make it the way you want to make it.
Yeah, yeah.
No matter.
Yeah, but I love that you have done all the research to
yeah.
back up and to understand the origins of all these flavors. And that's why your book is just delightful.
Thank you.
It really is.
When I started on this project, I just realized that a lot of this research had not been done. There are a few good books on a few of the things.
Yeah.
There are some really good theses out there, but I also had to do a lot of primary source research. Because the stories that were out there, the deeper I dug, I just found out were wrong, weren't the right stories.
Uh-huh.
And then when I found these stories, I found that there are such fascinating tales of Americans and Americans that don't normally get written about. Women, black people, immigrants. These are the people who have really shaped our country and who have shaped our dinner tables, too.
Yeah. We don't have that much time left, so I want to kind of speed through
yeah.
two more
yeah.
if we have time. Let's talk about soy sauce.
Okay.
Yes.
Tell us soy sauce.
So soy sauce, surprisingly, the first soy sauce brewery in the Western Hemisphere was in Georgia in the middle of the 18th century. It was by a British immigrant who had also been a sailor for the East India Company. And somehow when he was in China, he got his hands on soybeans and he learned how to grow them and he learned how to ferment soy sauce. And he began creating it and selling it. And he was serving a need of actually the largely Anglo people that live there because of this trade with East India. Britain had already been cooking with these sort of variations on soy or fish sauce made with local ingredients. Plenty of American cookbooks are filled with these like fermented walnut or fermented tomato sauces, which eventually that one evolves into ketchup. So this kind of like dark, savory, salty, fermented umami, you know, because it's got mm-hmm. it has MSG in it, even mm-hmm. when you brew it naturally, was already part of American food. But then we kind of like forgot about it in the 19th century and stopped using it as much until we get this wave of Chinese immigration. So then we start using it again in the early 20th century to mimic Chinese food, to make chop suey at home, to like seem very daring in terms mm-hmm. of what you're cooking for your bridge party. you can picture, right?
Yeah.
And then it really becomes American again when Kikkoman builds its first manufacturing plant in America, which that was built in the early 1970s, and it was the first Japanese manufacturing plant
and
of any
was
kind.
That?
It was in Wisconsin. You've got you've got my notes in front of you, essentially, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So that's out of Milwaukee.
Right.
So it's in the Midwest. They did it to be close to their product, to close to soybean growers, because at this point, Japan was importing most of its soybeans to meet demand. So they said, well, why don't we build the factory next to the soybean fields?
Mm-hmm.
And about the same time, they also released a cookbook, the cover, which is amazing. It's an American dad, and he has a Japanese wife, and they've got two mixed race children. So this is
what year is this?
1971 or two that it comes out. So it's like this is post war. There is this idea of war brides that American men met Japanese women,
mm-hmm.
and unlike other immigrations, then these women were not immigrating into Japanese communities. They were kind of forcibly and directly integrated into American culture because of their husbands. So they would end up in the middle of wherever. And so they kept their food traditions, kept cooking Japanese food. So this cookbook is not really for them, but sort of promoting this cultural idea. Mm-hmm. And it has very traditional Japanese recipes in it, but it also has recipes for like meatloaf with soy sauce in it, which for me, I think of my favorite Thanksgiving side, Campbell's green bean casserole,
right?
Which one of the ingredients in it is a tablespoon of soy sauce. Mm-hmm. So it's Kikkoman and this sort of cultural movement that makes soy sauce. It's like, oh, add a little bit to make things taste richer and more delicious, and turns it into this ingredient that transcends Japanese or Chinese cooking into just an American ingredient.
Mm-hmm. Wow. It's the book is... The research that you've done, Sarah, and talking to you is inspiring.
Thank
it's
you.
Really fun. Okay, quick.
Yep.
Sriracha.
Sriracha is the last chapter. What I'm really excited about, because no one has really written this story yet. Sriracha, we assume, is very foreign and imported, and it's actually created entirely just outside of Los Angeles in Southern California from local Southern Californian ingredients by the Tran family. And David Tran and his family... They were refugees to America right after the Vietnam War. So I always say that, you know, immigrants are so important to this country in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And when you look at David Tran, not only is an entrepreneur, he started a business to support his family when he came here. And in fact, someone who's immigrated to this country is twice as likely to start a business as someone who was born here.
That's right.
And not only that, but he's a refugee. And especially when we're talking so much about refugees and the dangers they present, one of the greatest condiments ever created was created by this refugee family. And we wouldn't have that if we decide to keep people out of this country. I mean, in a way, that is a very small fraction of what we would lose by stopping immigration in America. But I think it's also particularly powerful. To me, their story is quintessentially American, and they've created this quintessentially American flavor, too.
And it really, I feel like in the last 10 years, it is just booming.
Yeah, absolutely. Business. Absolutely. Actually, when I proposed this book about 5 years ago, one of the editors looking at it said, I don't know what sriracha is. It shouldn't be in this book. I've never heard of it. And I'm a foodie. And I was like, well, that's not your job to decide that. And you will hear of it. So now I think of her.
It's in everything now.
It's in everything now.
They've branded themselves.
Yep.
Like,
yep, absolutely.
Yeah. It's amazing.
And they are the nicest people, and they totally deserve it. And I went and toured the factory.
And the sauce
The sauce is purple.
So great.
It's designed for us. It's slightly sweet. Mm-hmm. It's got garlic in it, and it's made with jalapeno peppers. Mm-hmm. So compared to a Tabasco sauce, it is a fraction of the heat. Mm-hmm. So you can put more in. You've got more room to sort of play and adjust the heat of the food you're making, because you're starting with something that's not like burn your mouth off hot.
That's more mild.
Yeah. And there's so many knockoffs now.
Yeah.
So even, you know, he had his business with his own secret sauce, so to speak, and recipe.
Right.
But it's inspired a lot of other people. I think they were the impetus for this whole, you know, passion for chili sauces, right?
Yes.
Sarah?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, and we have been eating chili sauces for a long time. Tabasco's founded in the 1860s. So in a way, there's this other stereotype that Americans don't like spicy food, but that's not what the record shows. It shows that the Americans have loved spicier and spicier food over time. Now, one of the things that makes sriracha popular is because it is more mild. It's more appealing to a broader audience, too, in America. But also, it's like a gateway drug. Spicy foods are addictive. Every time we have it, our brain, it triggers receptors in our mouth that we actually think we're being burned, and so our brain releases endorphins to counteract that, to make us feel good so we don't panic. But then when it's like a roller coaster, it puts you in danger, but it's not real danger. So then when it's over, you're like, oh, I want to do that again. Endorphins are addictive. And so that's why we keep going back to hot food, and why we keep going back and getting spicier and spicier hot food too.
It's the perfect
I can definitely relate to that. I went out to eat. I took my cousins from Italy to Grand Szechuan in Chelsea, one of the best Chinese restaurants I've ever eaten. And it's just a dumpy little place. And everything was spicy. And at first, everyone was like, okay, we're kind of like, but by the end, we couldn't stop eating it. They're like, this is so spicy, but we can't stop eating it, you know?
Yeah.
I felt like a mild euphoria by the end of the night from the spice.
And you absolutely did. That's your brain.
Yeah. Well, that's why it's so good when you're sick and under the weather.
Yeah.
You know, spicy food.
Spicy food.
It clears everything out.
Yep.
It makes you feel good.
Yep.
It makes your body rest.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
And
no, we're a spicy food eating country.
Yeah.
And even more so is immigration shifts. As more people are coming from Central America, more people are coming from Southeast Asia, our food has gotten spicier over the past 30 years of right. that immigration has picked up.
Right.
Well, you go a little bit, I kind of want to end, Sarah, with you. I want you to sort of do a little bit of prediction.
Yeah.
Immigrants are going to keep coming in spite of certain politicians' best efforts.
Yep. I certainly hope
so. They're going to keep coming to the U.S. and changing what we eat and the flavors that we use.
Mm-hmm.
What? Let's be a pundit for a minute now mm-hmm. and tell us what you think the ninth flavor might be.
Well, in my conclusion, I look at a lot of different flavors that could potentially be the ninth flavor. So I'm trying to look at things that are not just a trend and something that goes beyond just being popular, but to something that will be long lasting. And to me, and I already mentioned this a little bit, I think the most powerful sort of trend and also idea based on the things that I've learned before is that our food is definitely going to get more Middle Eastern and is going to reflect a lot more flavors of Middle Eastern cuisine.
That's going to scare a lot of people.
Well, you know, that's the thing about immigration. We often accept the food.
We're always scared in the beginning.
We
right?
accept the food sometimes before we accept the immigrants themselves. So
agreed.
That's just it.
Agreed.
We have Donald Trump saying that he's going to ban Muslims from entering this country, but you can buy hummus in any grocery store.
Yeah.
It's a regular part of my grocery trip. So, and falafel carts on the streets. So
right.
that's fine. We'll
chickpeas,
take their food.
Right.
Absolutely.
Sesame oil.
So
the
one thing I call out specifically is I call out rose water, which is an ingredient that we associate not only with Middle Eastern, but also Indian food. And that is actually an ingredient that was incredibly common in America in the 18th century. And it was really replaced by vanilla, which was just trendier at the time. So now it's sort of coming back again in its own right and is being used in totally different ways. So I think we're going to see a lot more Middle Eastern flavors in general, but maybe a lot more rose water specifically coming around. That's certainly what I'd be interested to research and write about.
So buy some stock
mm-hmm, buy
in
some
the rose water industry.
And stop being scared of Muslims. And since this is my show, I'm going to go ahead and say it. Go ahead and vote Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
I'm voting for Hills tomorrow.
I'm with her.
And I'm with her. And seriously, as a woman, as an entrepreneur, yay! And as someone who advocates for immigrants, she is the president I want. I think she's absolutely awesome. I think she's great. And she represents the country I want to live in, a country that's diverse in terms of
right.
people, language, culture, religion, and food, too.
Yeah, she eats more than fast food. Let's put it that way.
And she carries sriracha in her bag, doesn't she? Or is it Tabasco? She carries spice.
She does.
Yeah.
She said, when I saw the interview, she just says hot sauce.
Hot
which
sauce.
I was thinking about yesterday. I also work at the Lower East Side Tenement Museum, and a bunch of us have hot sauce. We all have hot sauce packets in our our like mailboxes at work just in case. So that's becoming this big part of American culture. We're not bland food.
No.
We're really addicted to heat, and that is American culture changing because of the people that have come here.
Right.
We spend a lot of time talking about immigrants must change, immigrants must do this, they must speak English, they must be American.
Just keep cooking.
We ignore how we change and we become more immigrant and how our culture shifts. Even that fast food, Carmen, hot dogs and hamburgers, that's German food.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can't separate it from American cuisine because of how many Germans came here in the 19th century. So, you know, pizza, burritos.
Yeah. Right.
This is American food.
Right.
Hummus.
Hummus.
Yeah.
Hummus and rose water.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Thank you, Sarah.
My pleasure.
This show was written and produced by Carmen DeVito and Alice Krieg. Remember to check out our website, WeDigPlantsPodcast.com, or on Twitter at WeDigPlants to stay current on our projects and upcoming shows. Also follow us on Instagram at Groundworks Gardens NYC. Thanks for listening. We'll see you in the virtual garden, and thank you, Sarah.
Buy the book, 8 Flavors, The Untold Story of American Cuisine, out December 6th in pre-sale now. Get on Amazon and get yourself a copy.
Do it.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Food Radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.